Welcome back. From the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin, I'm RJ McGill.
And I'm Ashley Bamford, and this is the spring edition of Berlin Journal. Today, we'll be hearing from some of the fellows and residents at the Hans Arnold Center this semester. As usual, our fellows represent a wide range of interests and disciplines, from synthetic biology to the new sharing economy, from revolution in Ethiopia to the boundaries of privacy in the digital age.
But first, Berlin Journal's Jeff Rosenberg has a report from the Richard C. Holbrook Forum, which took place in Washington at the Brookings Institution in February.
Listeners to this program may recall that in an earlier edition, we presented the Richard C. Holbrook Forum, created in late 2013. It's a unique entity designed to tackle the most difficult assignments in global affairs. The forum brings together a select international group of policy and legal experts, as well as distinguished scholars. They spend several days in intensive and confidential deliberations aimed at bringing the Holbrookian method to bear on seemingly intractable problems. In February, the forum's fifth session took place in the U.S. for the first time, for meetings jointly sponsored by the Brookings Institution in Washington. The meeting was titled, The Global Migration Crisis, Its Challenges to the United States, Europe, and Global Order. Although the crisis has been well covered in domestic U.S. news media, participants struggled with the question of how to get more informed and sympathetic discussion of the crisis into the national media.
Given the suffering, the magnitude of the suffering in Syria and of the refugees, every morning of every day, the president and Schumer and Reid and the other governors and archbishops and rabbis and mullahs and ex-presidents from both parties and every celebrity who ever won an Academy Award, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and everyone else, every day of every morning should get up and re-legitimate the idea of refugee assistance and our humanitarian obligations. This is, you know, we are a republic of opinion. We govern ourselves by our opinion, and the quality of our self-government is determined by the quality and the content of our opinions about things.
That's Leon Wieseltier, a senior fellow at Brookings and one of the forum's participants. His greatest concerns are for the moral dimensions of the refugee crisis, an area where many of the participants focused their attention. His comments came near the close of the sessions. The Holbrook Forum and Brookings offered a number of the participants for a rare public presentation. Michael Ignatieff is a co-chair of the Holbrook Forum and a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also a journalist and a former member of the Canadian Parliament. He sees the crisis as tied directly to America's commonly held values as a nation.
What I entirely share with Leon, though I've argued with him for 30 years and we could argue some more, what I entirely share is that this is a definitional moment about who we are, what societies are, what the United States is, what its traditions are. The refugee issue is not a humanitarian crisis. It's a definitional crisis. And I think in that sense, we're on, as they say, the same page.
There isn't any more fundamental encounter with our values, with our conscience, with our self-definition than children dying at sea and the banalization of children dying at sea. So it is definitional of who we are. The thing I see very clearly is that in the United States, the Syrian refugee crisis is seen fundamentally as a kind of Middle Eastern problem. The order of the Middle East is collapsing, and it's produced a humanitarian crisis. In Europe, the situation is seen in very different ways. It's seen as a huge inflow of persons that are challenging the boundary conditions of the nation state. If there's a hero in the story, it has been not just Chancellor Merkel, but ordinary Germans who said, this is definitional of us. This is the time to show ourselves and the world we are different. And the problem they are facing, they built that post-war Germany on the Marshall Plan, on American involvement, on NATO commitments, on George Bush Sr.'s leadership and the reunification, on Dick Holbrooke's work to get the Balkans sorted. The entire German identity we're looking at post-war was built in conjunction and collaboration with the United States. And in 2015, the Germans are looking out across their parapet as 3,000 people a day are streaming in right now, and they're saying, our chief strategic ally is a bystander. Our chief strategic ally is willing to take in 2,000 people from Syria since 2011. Not 2,000 a week, not 2,000 a year, but 2,000 over 4 years. Talk about self-images of a country. This country, I'm not an American, I'm a Canadian, I'm next door, I love you guys, but your self-image is we are the land of multicultural welcome. We are the country with a great refugee welcome record. We're the country that when UNHCR wants us to take, you know, 65,000, 70,000 a year, we do. The United States has a great tradition. But over Syria, it's shut down. And this is creating, this was the burden of the Holbrooke Forum discussions, which I'm sharing with you, is that the Europeans are looking with utter disbelief at the fracture of a transatlantic partnership that built the Europe that they grew up in. You've got a United States, the most powerful, the strongest country in the world, who's decided on the refugee issue that you simply cannot take any risk whatever. It's not merely that you can manage the risk, you can't take any risk. And a country that sends a strategic message to the world that we are so frightened that we can't remain committed to the things that make the whole world like us is a great power in serious trouble. And a country that will not support its allies as it faces the biggest challenge to their identity, to their cohesion, since the Second World War, is not a serious country.
I say this with affection. You can't be more pro-American than I am. But if you hear anger here, there is anger. Sorry, I'm steamed about this.
Michael Ignatieff of the Kennedy School at Harvard University and co-chair of the Richard C. Holbrooke Forum. He spoke at the conclusion of the forum's most recent sessions held in Washington at the Brookings Institution. You can see a video of the forum's public panels and learn more about the work of the Holbrooke Forum on the Academy's website, americanacademy.de. Enter Holbrooke Forum in the search window. For Berlin Journal, I'm Jeff Rosenberg.
A reminder that you're listening to the Berlin Journal. This is our spring edition, and it comes to you from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. I love the people who talk with NPR, new mothers, Nobel Prize winners, physicists, farmers. And I love the people who listen, hackers, truckers, kids, grandmas, listening to the news and each other to learn more than they already know. To me, this is the beautiful sound of democracy. This is NPR.
Like many alert contemporaries, writer Harry Kunzru often finds himself worrying about privacy, worrying about surveillance, and worrying about data mining and credit card fraud. He finds these worries reflected everywhere around him in the culture. But what precisely, Kunzru asks, is threatened when privacy is threatened?
I've had a long suspicion that there's a relationship between what we understand as personal privacy and the definition of being human. And now whether you feel that the human is something that we ought to hold on to at all costs, or whether the human is something that we ought to overcome in order to move ourselves on to the next phase, you get into this idea about protecting a space of interiority, of protecting a space that's not accessible to networks, it's not accessible to others, that's not exposed on social media, that's not always available for scrutiny and for quantification.
At the Academy this semester, Kunzru is working on a project called The Lyric Eye, which is concerned with, among much else, the relationship between privacy and human subjectivity. If I have no privacy, he asks, am I still human? For our program today, we asked Berlin-based poet and translator Alexander Booth to talk with Harry Kunzru.
One writer that I feel sort of ghosts throughout much of your work, and we've talked about this in the past, is William Burroughs. Something that he was very interested in was this idea of control, and that's something that I've noticed throughout your work is also a very important theme, be it political, technological, cultural, sexual, drugs. Why is this such an important theme to you?
I think very early on, I got interested in cybernetics, actually kind of not really knowing that it was, by the time I was reading about it, it had become slightly outdated as a sort of set of thoughts, you know, had a period of being fashionable in the 60s and 70s. And then I sort of stumbled across it in the late 80s, early 90s. And the cybernetic picture of the world is a very simple one, is about understanding everything as networks of command and control. And that's quite a powerful explanatory tool if you look at complicated systems. You know, here we are sitting in a recording studio, and around, you know, you might think, well, on one level, we've got a bunch of technology, there are some people, there's a building, but you can kind of understand that in terms of systems that are human and technological and physical, are all kind of under one explanatory regime. And I think we're in a historical moment where questions of technology and questions of politics are getting very, very bound up together. Questions of how power emerges in complicated systems. You know, we're past the era of the 20th century totalitarianisms, where it was pretty easy to see who was in charge because he was, you know, at a podium wearing a uniform and you were all cheering him. Whereas now we're under control rather than authority in that top-down way. And I think we need to be quite sophisticated about understanding how information works in that, how things like culture work in that, how our behavior is modeled and nudged and kind of put together in ways that aren't straightforwardly about, you know, a man in jackboots telling you to go here or to go there. And all these questions, I think, are very well addressed by the form of the novel. It's why one reason I find novels exciting to write is that I am allowed to be of a generalist in that way and to bring together all sorts of different kinds of explanation. And, you know, you can shape them all into stories, and you can go inside somebody's soul, and then you can kind of iris out and you can show the Battle of Waterloo. You know, you have that wonderful power that filmmakers and other people just don't have.
I was thinking about your novel from 2007, My Revolutions. How, in your opinion, has ideology changed in the face of technology and the changes that you've been speaking about?
Well, for a while there was an idea that we were entering a post-political moment, that all the ideological divisions of had been solved with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that somehow it was just going to be a kind of technocratic future where it was going to be about efficient management, and nobody would really believe stuff in the way that they used to believe stuff. And that's a moment that's now past. It's very clear that there are plenty of people who believe things quite strongly and aren't interested in submitting themselves to market, liberal, technocratic solutions. But also that there's a sort of subtle undermining of the idea of belief, a sort of afoot. We like quantification. We like evidence-based things. We like to feel we're rational even when we're not being rational. And so, I mean, the great trick of ideology is to pretend, to make you feel that it doesn't exist. And we have a huge amount of ideology around us all the time, but it is very, very sophisticated now at pretending to be neutral.
Do you think it's key, as your character in My Revolution says, all I'd wanted was a certainty, a solid place to stand?
Well, I think that's a desire that I have tried to give up. That's almost the fundamental mistake one can make about trying to live in the world, is expecting that if you only thought hard enough or did a certain thing or obeyed God, you'd find that still point and you'd find that solid ground beneath your feet. I mean, I think we're all like the Roadrunner or Elmer Fudd, kind of, you know, who's long, long way off the cliff and our little legs are still going and there's no ground beneath our feet, and it's just whether we choose to believe we can kind of stay up or whether we fall.
Harry Kunzru, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Author Harry Kunzru, the Mary Ellen von der Heyden Fellow this semester at the American Academy, talking with poet and translator Alexander Booth. You can watch Harry Kunzru's reading at the American Academy on our website, americanacademy.de. Time for a break. And when we come back, we're off to Ethiopia with documentary filmmaker Yamani Demesi. You're listening to Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin.
1 minute after 5 in the morning.
Aid is beginning to flow into areas devastated by Ecuador's strongest earthquake in decades.
1 minute after noon.
Hillary Clinton won New York's Democratic presidential primary.
1 minute after 5 in the evening.
While Castro will remain at the helm of Cuba's Communist Party.
1 minute after 11 at night.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump earned a huge victory in the New York primary.
What's happening? What's known? What's next? 1 minute after the hour. Every hour, every day. From NPR News.
Welcome back to the spring edition of Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin. I'm Ashley Bamford.
In my work as a filmmaker, I'm interested in the relationship between change and violence, conviction and empathy, and memory and regeneration.
Yamane Demise teaches film at New York University, and he's both a documentary and feature filmmaker himself. As a member of the Ethiopian diaspora, he's fascinated with the modern history of a nation that has gone through a tumultuous period of war, revolution, uprisings, and an unbelievable transformation. In little less than half a century, Ethiopia was transformed from an ancient medieval empire into a modern nation-state. Here at the Academy this semester, Yamane Demise is completing a documentary series on the remarkable changes that swept Ethiopia from 1930 to 1975, when a coup d'etat overthrew Ethiopia's emperor Haile Selassie.
During the revolution in the 1970s, many individuals lost their lives. So the generation that made tremendous contributions in the transformation of the country was heavily affected. Many of them were imprisoned, many of them were killed, many of them left the country. And the individuals that I interviewed lived through a 400, a 500, a 600 year change and witnessed those transformations. And these transformations were primarily recorded in their memory because a lot of the documentation has disappeared because of the revolution.
For the Berlin Journal, Yamane Demise sat down for a talk with Anselm Franke, the head of video arts and film at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, one of the city's major cultural centers.
The Quantum Leapers project, right, consists mainly of you talking to individuals who have, in one way or another, played a role in Ethiopia's post-Second World War history. Right? Maybe you can give us a few examples of who these individuals are and how you're approaching them.
One of the reasons why I embarked on this project was for me to also understand 20th century Ethiopia, for me to also understand the revolution that happened in 1975, because I came of age after the revolution. And my understanding of what existed before and what happened before was influenced by what was communicated during the revolutionary years. And oftentimes, or most of the time, what was communicated during the revolutionary years was filtered through the prism of ideology. So many of these individuals that I talked to did not come from aristocratic or noble families. Many of them became self-made individuals, and many of them participated in the regime. But then, because of their education, because of their experiences, they soon became part of the elite.
And maybe you could give us a few examples just of people and their lives and their entanglement, you know, of the personal with the grander schemes of the country's history.
Okay, so there's this individual who was a bureaucrat who worked for the Ministry of Defense for many years. And at the very end of the interview, I was asking him about the eve of the revolution and about the challenges that existed within the administration. He sort of put things in perspective in that he said that it was very difficult for people who came of age in the 1960s to be aware, especially if they lived in the cities, to be aware of the significant and very, very fast changes that had taken place in the country. And he said that he understood the need and the hunger for accelerated change. But he said that the change was already enormous. So he gave me an example. He and his father went to the capital in 1929. That was a year before the emperor's coronation. And they'd traveled about 400 kilometers, and it took them a month. And he said that on the eve of the revolution, he flew from his hometown to the capital, and he said he arrived at the capital before his coffee got cold.
That's a good thing.
And then I'll give you another example. This woman, her father was an Eritrean, and he left Eritrea in the early 20s to learn how to drive, to learn some trade, because it was impossible for him to do so in Eritrea. And he came to Ethiopia. He had a difficult time getting what he wanted. Somehow he lucked out, went to France, and learned how to be a mechanic. Comes back, but then how many cars are there at that time? Very few. The people that owned cars were essentially the leadership. So one day he's at the church, and the empress is there, and the crown prince, Haile Selassie Teferi Mekonnen, his name was at that time, was there. The empress gets into her car, she leaves, and Teferi Mekonnen, they try to start his car, doesn't work. This guy goes there, fixes the car, and he's hired as the emperor's chauffeur. So within one leap, because of this need that existed, he becomes the mechanic. Now, at that time, there were no telephones in the country. Or if there were, there were very few telephones. Now, his daughter, who's telling me the story, when she grew up in the late 20s and the early 30s, there was no telephone in her house. In 1942, she is hired by the telecommunications office to become an operator in Addis Ababa. And at that time, for the entire city, there were two operators, and she was one of them. Mm-hmm. When I interviewed her, she would periodically pick up her cell phone and talk to some people and then come back to the interview. So this is again, another transformation that she witnessed and I witnessed, but then, of course, she's not aware of it because most of these people, as they're living through their lives, it's not often that people stop to think about these transformations that have taken place. People just learn to adapt very, very quickly. Yes. And especially these individuals have adapted to multiple changes in multiple universes. And then the other thing is also what I also discovered myself is that there's very little data. We've assessed that entire time period with very little data. Mm. And what I'm more interested in is the information, are the narratives. Because before we even assess, before we even interpret, we need to have the material to interpret. And a lot of that time period was assessed with very thin data.
Documentarian, author, and professor Yemane Demise of New York University, speaking with Anselm Franke of Haus der Kultur in der Welt. You can watch Demise's presentation about his documentary series on the American Academy website, americanacademy.de. You're tuned to the Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin. We'll be back in a moment after this brief break.
Think about the birth of an idea and all the possibilities it presents.
The big idea here.
Whatever brilliant ideas
to
you
believe
have
in
or
the
hear.
True nature of reality
is the
beckons.
Gift of the human imagination.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for an audio journey through the big ideas of our time. Ideas that will change your view of the world on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
You're listening to NPR. NPR is asking tough questions and searching for the answers. NPR is witnessing the moment of triumph, or finding what's at the heart of a disaster. It's journalists across the globe and in your town. NPR is the relationship between you and me. This is NPR.
The This is Berlin Journal. I'm Ashley Bamford. Welcome back.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Lately, it's the American economy that's been bumpy, and one of the biggest bumps has been the massive changeover in the types of jobs Americans are taking on. For example, driving for Uber.
Uber, TaskRabbit, Upwork, these new companies are going a whole nother step further. They're virtually not much more than an app and a website. And they have a small core of employees and executives who oversee an army of freelancers and contractors and temp workers.
Academy fellow Stephen Hill has been writing and speaking a great deal about Uber and similar sharing economy companies. During his time at the Academy, Hill has been invited to speak at dozens of venues, including at Republica, the Hanover Messe, the Hasso-Plattner Institute in Potsdam, and the Future Internet Congress in Frankfurt. Here, he is speaking at the Telefonica Base Camp in Berlin in February.
And when you start having that kind of a situation, you lose the social dimension of your labor markets. The connection between employer and employee is no longer there. In fact, they like to say in this sharing and gig economy, these workers are the CEOs of their own corporation. They're, you know, Uber driver is the CEO of his or her, but it's mostly a his, driving business. And when something happens, like in San Francisco, an Uber driver took a right-hand turn, plowed over an entire family, killed a six-year-old girl, and badly injured her eight-year-old brother and her mother, Uber's response was, "We're horrible, sorry that that happened, but this driver does not work for us. This driver is an independent contractor. He's the CEO of his own driving business. That's who you need to deal with. We have nothing to do with this. We have no liability here, no responsibility whatsoever." That's the corporate mentality that's coming to us out of Silicon Valley through these sorts of companies.
Journalist and author Stephen Hill, talking about Uber, the massive ride-sharing business that's gone global and often used as the mascot for the new so-called sharing economy. In planning this program, we knew right away that our listeners would want to hear what Steve Hill has to say about the drastic changes that have taken hold in the American workplace. There are predictions for dire consequences for the economy and for workers if the situation is ignored. Hill is the author of Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. His writings have created a real stir on both sides of the Atlantic. When Stephen Hill spells out the Silicon Valley-style changes already underway in the U.S. economy, it often leaves readers and listeners dumbfounded.
From the employer's perspective, by hiring a contractor or a freelancer, in many cases, you don't have to pay Social Security costs. You don't have to pay for things like health care, injured worker compensation, unemployment compensation. You get out of all of that. And you're saving, anywhere from 25 to 30% of your labor costs. So the incentives for employers to do this is clear. You know, if they can get out of paying all that and they're in a competitive market, that's what they're going to do. There was an example in the U.S., the pharmaceutical company Merck, very large company. They had a plant in Philadelphia. They sold the plant to another company. The company laid off all 400 workers, then hired back all 400 workers as contractors to get out of those labor costs for the Social Security, and then proceeded to make the exact same drugs for Merck that Merck was making for itself. So these are the incentives that are there in the system, and if we're not careful, that's going to completely undermine jobs, the middle class, and ultimately the viability of our macroeconomy, since the economy is driven 70% by consumer spending. If you don't have enough people with enough money in their pockets and in their bank accounts to buy up the goods and services that your businesses are producing, you're in trouble. And we're already showing signs that we're reaching that kind of critical economic singularity, as I call it in my book, Raw Deal.
His fellowship at the Academy is allowing him to learn firsthand how the German economic and social system differs from the American.
There are certain types of workers today in Germany. I don't know the German word, but it has something to do with what's called them solo entrepreneurs. And, you know, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 4 to 6% of the German labor force is working this way now. And these are contractors and freelancers who do not have Social Security coverage. In other words, there's no employer that's paying their half of Social Security. So it's quite expensive for them to be this sort of solo, self-employed type of worker. I just met someone at a conference yesterday, a woman who
you know, does consulting and she does design work and, you know, people who work doing childcare, who clean homes, all sorts of occupations like this are not covered by the social system here. Germany does have something, Künstler Sozialkasse, that covers artists and journalists and people make a living in that way. So I think that's a model that Germany can build upon and extend it to all these other occupations and industries that are not covered. But in addition, you know, we have global companies that are hiring German workers as freelancers and, you know, companies like Upwork, which is a company based in Silicon Valley in San Francisco. Upwork is a company with about 250 employees, regular employees. That those 250 employees oversee 10 million freelancers around the world. And these freelancers are doing all sorts of things like, you know, computer programming, designing a graphic logo. There are architects and lawyers on that platform getting work. And so, you know, you can look on that platform and you can see there's German workers or American workers saying, hey, I'd like to make 60 euros or $60 an hour for this job. And then you see workers from Thailand and India say, I'll take 2 euros. An hour. And these workers in Thailand and India are highly skilled. They have the technology to do the job. And so, you know, a lot of people are hiring them instead of hiring developed world workers. So it becomes this, it's basically an online auction in which the lowest bid wins. And so it makes a race to the bottom is what was happening. So those workers are also not covered if they're German workers here working through these different labor platforms. And some of these labor platforms now are starting to spring up in Europe as well. You know, now you have a million new refugees here, migrants, and they're going to have to be integrated, and that affects the labor market. And actually, these labor platforms could help with that process if they're properly regulated, because they do allow people who can't get a regular full-time job to plug in and get some kind of work. It does allow labor market outsiders, as it's called, to find work easier because they can go on, you know, a platform and find some work instead of just sitting around unemployed. So that's where I'm really looking to see how Germany and other countries in Europe react to this, if they can come up with the regulations that will make this an okay way to work without exploiting these workers and just making it another way for business to reduce their labor costs and be able to fire and hire workers, you know, without any consideration to the social considerations of doing that. So that it's been interesting to be here and have those conversations with people, which are still ongoing for me. I'm still meeting with a lot of people and appearing at a lot of conferences and talking to people there. So it's all been good.
In all of Stephen Hill's exchanges, it always comes back to solutions. How does a huge economic system go about shifting gears? And what added components can bring back fairness to a system that many no longer see as functional for the long term?
The broad question is, you know, if we're going to move to this type of economy that in which workers are going to be working in all these different ways, how do we construct the economy around them so that they are benefiting and not just leaves blowing in the wind of the labor market? And so, looking at it from that perspective, different countries are responding to this better, or already have a system that is more easily adaptable to this system. So in Germany and Denmark and in Europe in general, especially Western Europe, you have systems that are very much adaptable to this. Not only are the systems already in place, like Künstler Sozialkasse, that can be expanded, but also there's just more of an attitude. You have stronger labor unions that once, you know, are more on board with this, will be able to fight for this. You have more, there's more acceptance of what I call the visible hand of government. You know, the idea that government should be involved in helping to establish the rules and regulations for this, whereas in the U.S., Americans are so very anti-government, sometimes they just shoot themselves in the foot. Because when you know, a worker up against a big, huge company, who else is going to help you and be even a referee but government? And so, you know, the U.S., I think, is really in some ways the worst position for the changes that are happening in the world in this regard, because we don't have a strong safety net. for workers. It's going to be harder to expand it to the increasing number of workers who are working as freelancers and contractors. We don't have strong labor unions. The labor movement is down to about 6.7% of the private sector labor force is now unionized. And Americans are suspicious of government. So, we have a lot of work to do in the United States to move things in the direction where we'll be able to pass some of the laws. I mean, I think where that's going to happen first in the United States will be at the local level, because a lot of these changes that I've proposed, like having a universal portable safety net, you can enact that at the local level. So San Francisco, New York City, the city councils that tend to be more center-left, Democrats, progressive, whatever you want to call it, and are more open to these sorts of interventions, that's where I think we could pass these first. And then in states like California, New York, Illinois, that tend to be more liberal states, we could then use the local foundation as a building towards state and then eventually towards the federal arena. This is how big changes have often passed in the United States over time, is first you pass them at the local and state level, and eventually it gets to the federal level.
Of course, Stephen Hill is not naive about the chances. The likelihood that government, business, and workers will make the right choices that will bring back long-term stability to our dynamic economy.
David Plouffe was the campaign manager for Barack Obama in 2008, brilliant campaign strategist. He's been hired by Uber to be their chief campaign strategist as well as PR flack. And he's extremely effective. He's very well connected to Democratic administrations in many, many cities. The de Blasio administration in New York City, for example, when they were talking about restricting Uber drivers, the number of Uber drivers because of congestion, Plouffe was brilliant at mobilizing Democratic politicians and constituencies to stop that. He's been all over the country talking about why Uber is good, and he targets, Democratic mayors who hope to get appointed in some sort of mayoral presidential administration. And so here you have this insider Democrat in Seattle, for example, when the Seattle City Council proposed a law that would allow NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to organize Uber drivers. And the reason why they proposed it this way is because Uber drivers are contractors, and according to federal labor law, contractors cannot form a union. It's a ridiculous part of federal labor law, goes back decades, but this is the reality. So it's basically an end around this law. So Seattle City Council, which has had a lot of problems with Uber and Lyft and ride sharing, Seattle City Council, they had strong support. Suddenly there's David Plouffe on the scene, insider Democrat, saying you should not pass a labor law to allow workers to organize. I mean, this was a huge new direction for the Democratic Party in the middle of a presidential election year to be basically saying you should not support collective bargaining for these drivers. Fortunately, the Seattle City Council did not listen to him. They ignored him, and they passed it unanimously. Well, one of the barriers in the United States is the political institutions are quite antiquated at this point. We don't have public financing of campaigns. We don't have proportional representation electoral systems where you can have multi-party democracy. I've written several books on this subject that we could go on, and we could do another radio show just on that, on the many challenges in terms of making the political system one geared for the 21st century instead of the 18th century. But that's why I think you have to start at the local level, because at the local level, you can have more impact. Individual citizens and then organizations that don't have a lot of money can have more impact. A city like San Francisco, Seattle, you see citizens groups that don't have as much money as, say, the real estate developers have, that are still able to get victories in certain ways. So I think by getting something passed at the local level, getting it in place, working out the bugs, making it work right, and then scaling it up to the state level and then on to the federal level, it's going to take many years in the United States. Europe might be able to move forward with these things more quickly because it has a number of advantages, as I mentioned earlier.
Journalist and author Stephen Hill, Holzbrinck Fellow at the American Academy this semester. His new book is called Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. You can see Stephen Hill's lecture on the future of work on our website, americanacademy.de.
You're tuned to Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin. We'll be back in a moment after this brief break.
Hi, it's Diane Rehm. I've been in public radio for a long time. I've made it my life's work, so you know I'm passionate about public radio. It's true, there are now more ways than ever to get news and information, but not one of these can take the place of NPR. This is NPR.
This is Jeff Rosenberg from the American Academy's Berlin Journal Show. Be sure to listen to our new podcast of interviews and features with our fellows and distinguished visitors. You can find it on our website, americanacademy.de, and on iTunes.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Sophia Rust, who's an associate professor at the History of Science Department at Harvard and the Anna Maria Kellen Fellow this spring here at the American Academy.
Princeton historian Michael Gordon was tapped to introduce our next fellow, Sophia Rust, on the occasion of her presentation at the Academy this semester. We'll step back and let him do the honors.
Sophia is interested in the meaning of life. Who isn't, you might say? But she's not concerned with the usual significance of that phrase, which usually calls up ethics or theology. She's interested in life. What does that term mean? Today we live in an age saturated with sciences and the life sciences, perhaps above all. Much of the work today in defining and shaping the notion of life takes place in that realm. Whatever else it also might be, life itself has become, and has been for a long time, a heavily biological concept. Sophia was trained as an ethnographer, and she looks for meaning the way anthropologists do. The people she studies are biologists, and they're the ones crafting the meanings of life she's currently interested in. I suppose you could just ask the biologists what they think life is. If you do that, you'll get very formulaic textbook answers. If your quarry is contemporary science, you need to do fieldwork, and the point of fieldwork, as Sophia writes in one of her articles, is not to replicate the discourse of practitioners, but to juxtapose what people say with what they actually do in real practice. If you want to see how the very concept of life is changing in the present, you need to see how biologists make the concept of life.
Michael Gordon, a historian at Princeton, talking about Sophia Rust's work as he introduced her presentation at the American Academy. Her lecture was entitled The Quick and the Dead. And now it's time to hear from Sophia herself.
The question that intrigues me is what life is. And obviously that's a really big question. So the way that I approach it is by focusing on people, what people think life is, how they talk about it. And in particular, I focus on life scientists, biologists, bioengineers, people like that. My first book is based on 8 years of fieldwork that I did with synthetic biologists. And synthetic biology is a burgeoning field that started in the first years of the 21st century. Researchers from mechanical engineering, chemical engineering, computer science, a number of other fields, came together and decided to think about biology as an engineering discipline. So the idea that kind of grounded that approach was that if they wanted to understand biology better, and biology as a discipline is dedicated to understanding how life works, then they would need to build new organisms or biological systems from scratch rather than experiment on extant organisms. Just knowing how and knowing why came together in biology, and you can see examples of that in other fields, but this was, as far as I can tell, the first time that people started thinking about life as something amenable to analysis through its construction.
So for Sophia Rust, the goal is to try to draw parallels between what has come before and what scientists are thinking about and working on now.
One historical example that I think is useful to kind of shore up that distinction is in the 17th century, natural philosophers believed that stones, fossils, were alive because they had, according to them, some kind of vital force. In German, you would call Lebenskraft, right? Some kind of potency to them. And if you fast forward to the end of the 20th century, you see, for example, artificial life scientists saying the same thing of their software, that it was alive. So as a historian, the question is, what could you possibly understand as the common denominator of those two things?
While a fellow at the Academy this past semester, Sophia Roos has turned the focus of her attention to a new but not entirely unrelated subject.
I'm interested in creatures that are very slow, that seem to be dead but then revive. This is called sometimes cryptobiosis or biological latency. But I wanted to expand beyond just organisms that can do this astonishing thing and think about other forms of latency in the life sciences. So I'm looking at things that were frozen in ice for millennia and then revived. I'm looking at, well, next month I'm going to Svalbard to look at the Global Seed Vault, which it's also called the Doomsday Vault. So these are seeds that are frozen from countries around the world. The idea that if there were some kind of global catastrophe, they could revive the world's crops. So I'm interested in that kind of technically enabled latency. What does it mean to freeze something and then hope that you're going to, well, not hope, because no one wants that to happen, but the idea that you're going to revive it for some later use.
As you might imagine, one of the questions that comes to Sophia Roost most frequently is why, as a historian of science, she is drawn so strongly to this topic. What's the history?
One of the reasons why I'm interested in this is I think if you look at the history of attempts to build living processes and non-living matter, automatons, robots, artificial intelligence, artificial life. So it's about biological processes like metabolism, reproduction, respiration, responsiveness, sometimes sentience, but they're always built into some kind of non-living stuff, right? So that way of thinking privileges form over matter. And I wanted to think about it differently, so I just flipped it and said, okay, what if we start thinking about biological substance that doesn't show any of the processes of life? And then what does that do to our thinking?
Sophia Roost, Associate Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University and an Anna Maria Kellen Fellow this semester at the American Academy in Berlin. Before we say our goodbyes, we have another departure to announce. Gerhard Casper, president of the American Academy in Berlin, will be finishing his tenure in July. We are grateful for his guidance, friendship, and steady hand. President Casper has had, of course, a very distinguished career before leading the Academy for the past year, including as the dean of the University of Chicago Law School and the president of Stanford. Gerhard Casper talked with us about his time here on the Wannsee.
The Academy does three things. It is a center for advanced study, it brings very distinguished visitors here, and it now does a public policy forum, the Richard Holbrooke Forum, which is dealing with very important issues such as refugees. What brought me particular pleasure was that with respect to distinguished visitors, I could also realize my own preferences. And we had some wonderful visitors here. For instance, Eric Kandel, the neuroscientist from Columbia, who is a friend of mine, Nobel Prize winner. Wendy Donninger, an Indologist at the University of Chicago, these days very famous and in India infamous because she has become the victim of fundamentalist Hindu politicians. And Frank Fukuyama, one of my Stanford colleagues. So we have had really intellectually a very lively and good period. What I found most interesting was you would assume that we have a kind of steady clientele, the same people showing up every week or every lecture. No, that's not the case. Instead, we have an extremely varied attendance. Sometimes it's the young, sometimes it's another group. We had a well-known Marxist professor from the University of Chicago. So many people wanted to come that we had to close registration because we cannot accommodate that many people here. And then his talk was live-streamed into a bar in Neukölln. So people are taking note of us everywhere in the city these days.
Almost certainly, Gerhard Casper's long years on college campuses guide his beliefs about how institutions can and should change to meet the needs of coming generations.
Going forward, the single most important goal has to be that we bring more young people to the Academy, to our events, and to the discourse. You know, the Academy is absolutely unique in the way it presents. But we need also more dialogue. We need more interaction with the Berlin public, and in particular, the younger public. And, you know, like all of us, all cultural institutions, we now make more use of social media and so on to get people interested in us. We had a wonderful event here. Yo-Yo Ma had approached us and had asked, would we be willing to host him for a small concert and a discussion with Syrian musicians. And so we did. And I learned that that was then in some way noted on Facebook. And we got 60,000 hits or friends. For us, that is indeed extraordinary.
And for Gerhard Kasper, above all, it's Berlin.
Berlin these days is praised by everybody as being one of the most vibrant cities in the world, basically. And I must say, what people are saying about Berlin is not only true, it is actually understating it. I have been quite overwhelmed by the fact that Berlin is now a hub of activities, intellectual, political, cultural. And of course, being here during the emergence of the refugee crisis gave me an introduction to an aspect of Germany that I had actually in this form never seen. You know, when I grew up, there were philanthropic organizations to help the poor and so on. There was a Red Cross. But these were all big organizations. And now what I see here is something that is really remarkable. Lots of small civil society groups that try to assist refugees or do have some other goals. And this kind of mobilization of civil society in Germany is remarkable. And I don't think anybody has quite caught up to what it means and will mean in the future.
Outgoing Academy President Gerhard Kasper. This coming August, Michael Steinberg, currently a professor of German music history at Brown University, will become the new president of the American Academy in Berlin.
And that's all for this edition of Berlin Journal, a production of the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin. Our production team includes Jeff Rosenberg and Christina Gonzalez in Berlin and Kingsley Smith in Washington. A special thanks to Anna Wolofsky of Alex Offener Kanal Berlin. From the American Academy, I'm Ashley Bamford.
And I'm RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on Berlin Journal.